If I tilt it 10 degrees to the north instead of 5, the disturbing force I'm applying to the gyroscope is greater, therefore it's going to precess faster. And the way the individual molecules on the perimeter of the gyroscope wheel are rotating is what's really causing the precession. Let me drop. If I could now do a high-speed movie, and I've got a bunch of red, green, blue, and whatever dots painted on the perimeter of the gyroscope wheel, and I'm looking at what's happening. At I've got the gyroscope spinning. I've got a high-speed photography showing me what's going to happen, so I can play it back in slow motion and watch what's happening. I've got the whole gyroscope tilted 5 degrees to the north, and at that instant of time, the red dot is now on the northern edge of the wheel, the red dot that's spinning on that wheel. All right, that red dot, the disturbing force, gravity is pulling it further to the north because that's the way I've tilted it. That red dot thinks it's being pushed downward to the north. When that red dot now rotates to the east because it's on the rotating wheel, it still has some of that downward velocity to it. Therefore, the whole darn wheel is going to try to trying to tilt down toward the east because of what you've done to the dot when it was north. You've applied a vertical force to the dot, the upsetting force of gravity. So that gives you a little bit of a feeling for why a gyroscope precesses. Let me drop. Now, instead of tilting the gyroscope 5 degrees to the north or 10 degrees to the north and watching it precess, if you could start off with it perfectly vertical, you would see no precession. But if instead of it being perfectly vertical, you took the bottom of the gyroscope that's normally against the table, and you put it into your fingers, your index finger, your middle finger, and your thumb, you've mounted it that way. And if you hold it perfectly still, it'll not precess. If now you move your hand in a circular manner, you can force a precession to take place. And depending on whether you move your hand in a circular manner, clockwise or counterclockwise, you can make different amounts of precession, and maybe even, yes, you can make precession in different directions. So, when you mount the second gyroscope on top of the first gyroscope, and the first gyroscope is precessing, let me drop. You're now using the precession of the first gyroscope to create a cyclic disturbing force to the second gyroscope, the one that's on top. And it's going to precess in a complicated manner. Gyroscopes are not simple. But when you reverse the procedure, the 5-inch gyroscope on the bottom and the 10-inch gyroscope on top, not only are they very unbalanced as to the heavy ones on top and the light ones on the bottom, but the precession rates are such that now it can very easily become unstable. Unless, if you could by some magic take the 5-inch gyroscope on the bottom and spin it at some ridiculously high speed, you might be able to, for a short period of time, make the small one on the bottom and the big one on top apparently stable for a short period of time. It would require a very fast spinning rate on the bottom small gyroscope. Let me drop. The gyroscope presents a kind of stiffness, is one way of describing it. If the bottom of the gyroscope was connected into some kind of a gimballing device in which it couldn't move, it could only tilt. And now you've got a gyroscope perfectly vertical, the shaft is perfectly vertical, you're spinning it real fast, it's sitting there still. And you push the top of the gyroscope to the north with your finger. It will respond by tilting itself to the east. It always responds at right angles to the force that's applied to it. That's the gyroscopic action. And depending on how much force you've got to apply to make it move is a function of how big is its wheel and how fast is it spinning. If you spin that wheel fast enough, you almost wouldn't be able to push it and make it respond, if you know what I mean. It'll act so stiff. So that gyroscopic stiffness is a function of how big is the wheel and how fast it spins. And when you start combining gyroscopes at right angles to each other, in the space shuttle, for instance, oh boy, all kinds of fancy things can happen. Over to you on this one so far, John. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I agree with most of what you said, because as you speed up, if you were to slow down the 10-inch and speed up the 5, you may be able to even get more length of time out of it, because effectively that's mass. So you're multiplying its mass, which gives it more stability and longer play time. But he's doing some interesting things. I don't know, he must have, I don't know, from the picture I have here, he
tempting to put a third gyroscope at right angles to the first two. putting one gyroscope with the axis along the X, one gyroscope with the axis along the Y, and one gyroscope along the axis with the Z, and they're all bound together with a frame. Let me drop. And now you spin them up, and you think you've got perfect stability. And I watched the astronauts do that on the space shuttle all about 10 years ago. I'm watching this on NASA Select Television. In weightlessness, they set up these three gyroscopes, and these three gyroscopes were you could stick them together as if they were pop beads. They were a kind of toy made out of pop beads with gyroscopes. And they stuck all three together. And when you do that, the slight amount of precession that's attempted by the one in X gets multiplied by the one in Y, gets multiplied by the one in Z, and if you put a mutual axis that's midway between X, Y, and Z, the whole combination of three of them wants to spin around that axis. They interact with each other. It's very unstable. The three astronauts set that up at right at X, Y, and Z, all at right angles to each other. Let me drop. And they let go of it. At first, it sat still in weightlessness in the middle of the space shuttle cargo hold, so to speak, where they were. Well, I think they were on the second floor of the space shuttle. All of a sudden, it started slowly rotating around that mutual axis I described that's halfway between X, Y, and Z. Some kind of 33-degree angle to each one of those three. It slowly started rotating around that mutual axis, and it started rotating faster and faster, and eventually the thing flew apart. So three gyroscopes at right angles to each other, no matter which direction they're spinning, is not a stable system. But two gyroscopes at right angles to each other are a perfectly stable system until you start applying a large disturbing force to it. At first, that's opposite of common sense. I wonder if you would have predicted those kind of reactions, John. KC2WGB, K2IW and TechNet.
Funny you should mention that, Dick. My Leica camera had a gyroscopic base that would mount on it. It had two gyros in it, not three, and they would spin up to 50,000 RPMs. You'd spin them up with a battery, and that was the steady shot at that time, and it worked extremely well. You had to really push that camera. You knew you were pushing it to get it to turn, but I often thought that three would be better than two, but from what you're saying, that brings another problem into view.
Yeah, due to the fact that each gyroscope, whenever you give it a disturbing force, it will move at right angles to the disturbing force you've given it. So the X and Y at right angles to each other, the disturbing forces are complementary, and everything's hunky-dory. But when you got three of them, X, Y, and Z axis, all connected together, the disturbing force of each one of them interacts in such a way that it rapidly becomes unstable. It wants to spin around that mutual axis. It will do that if you're not constraining it. So you don't need the third gyroscope. Two of them at right angles does the job. Now, that's going to make you ask an interesting question. In the case of the Kepler Space Telescope, which had four inertial wheels, they needed three to do the action they wanted, and the fourth one was a spare. Unfortunately, they did have two failures, therefore only two left. Did not allow them to do everything they wanted to do. Let me drop. The inertial wheels that are on the Kepler Space Telescope are not spinning at right angles to each other, three of them at a time, and connected together. The three of them are, in some cases, spinning along the X, Y, and Z axis, but they're not connected to each other. They're free floating in a gimbal. Now, depending on your servo mechanisms of the telescope that tries to apply a disturbing force to the inertial wheel that's along the X, the Y, or the Z axis, that allows you to reorient the whole telescope along some particular line of rotation. And you need three gyroscopes to have complete freedom to where you have the ability to point the telescope anywhere you want to. Hubble also has this problem. So you do have at least three gyroscopes operational, but they're not connected together. All three are in their individual gimbals, and when you're trying to steer the telescope in one particular direction, you're applying a force to one of the gyroscopes and let the other two swing free in their gimbals is what I think is taking place. So, in space, it's a complicated problem. We're about to go to the space report. Rich has a astronomy question, and astronomy is a subject often discussed on the space report, so let's do that. N2EO, K2RI, go ahead, Rich, with your astronomy question.
Okay, Dick. This is N2EO. You know, I'm always reading the news on Yahoo, because that's my homepage. And I saw something very interesting. I don't think it's a nut thing, but it seems a little far-fetched, so I wanted to check it out with you. They said there's a star called Tabby Star, with a T, Tabby Star. And they give you the number of the star, but I don't remember it. And it said in the last 100 years, the star dimmed about 20%, and now it dims and brightens abruptly. And they said there's no model for it. They've never seen it before. And we literally said... So anyway, there is some scientists out there. I don't know if they're nuts or what, but they said they believe, because there's no model for this, that it's some alien civilization building, as they put it, a superstructure around the star to harvest energy. Do you know anything about this, Nick? It seems far-fetched to me.
Dyson sphere, maybe?
Yeah, Mr. Dyson. What's Mr. Dyson's first name, if you happen to know, John? Go ahead.
No, I don't remember.
Yeah, this real smart guy who's done a lot of lecturing, named Dyson. I think he's now about 85 or 90 years old. Very interested in space. He predicted that the day will come when a very advanced society has to build something called a Dyson sphere. Let's assume now that we in the United States and Germany and Japan and whatever decide to really become green, and we build a whole lot of solar voltaic fields to gather solar power to give us all the electrical power we need. In theory, we can do that. And you cover more and more of the Earth with solar voltaics. You get more and more energy. Well, because your society is so advanced and you want to generate rocket fuel and whatever, you need more energy than that. So in theory, you could build a sphere of solar cells, so to speak, at the Earth's orbit around the sun, and you could gather all the energy coming out of the sun into your solar collectors that are this huge sphere. With the sphere, we are 93 million miles from the sun. So if you build a sphere with a radius of 93 million miles, and inside of that surface of the sphere is filled up with solar cells, in theory now you can gather every bit of energy that's coming out of that sun. That's the so-called Dyson sphere. So could an extremely advanced society need that amount of energy to carry on their operations? Let me drop it.
His name was Freeman, by the way, Dick, W-S-2-N.
Well done, Paul. I recognize it now, Freeman Dyson. So he recognized that the possibility exists that a very advanced society would build a Dyson sphere. Freeman Dyson predicted that as a possibility. Well, before the whole sphere rotating at the... In our case, the sphere would be rotating around the sun once every 365 days in order for gravity to hold it in the right position. And because the whole sphere has not been completed yet, you haven't filled up all the spaces with solar cells, as the sphere rotates, at first it's going to be just a ring at 93 million miles radius around the equator, if you know what I mean, from the sun's point of view. And so because you haven't filled it all up yet, you're going to see bright and dark spots when you're a long distance away looking at the amount of sunlight coming out of our sun. So whether or not a Dyson sphere could explain that, it's interesting, fanciful speculation. I'm very doubtful. The total amount of energy that sun hits us with on the Earth is so huge. Let me drop this. I think it's going to give us more than enough energy for many centuries to come from two points of view. One, we're going to make more and more efficient solar cells that are gathering more and more of the sunlight. Second of all, the appliances we use, our air conditioners, our lights and whatever, are all becoming more and more efficient. So the amount of energy we need to do our operations to some degree is decreasing as we make better machines. So you put the combination of more efficiency and more solar cells, I'm having great difficulty that we will need more area than we can establish on the Earth to gather the energy we need from the sun, because that sun is giving us, it's putting out 10 to the 27 watts. The total of, I've got an acre of property, and at high noon, 4.5 million watts of solar energy is hitting my property, even if I include the angle, you know, because I'm 40 degrees north of the equator. 4.5 million watts is hitting my property. If I could only gather 1% of that, it would be 43 kilowatts. It's a lot more energy than I would ever need. So you can see that the sun gives us a lot of energy. I don't think a Dyson sphere is required. And so you can make some science fiction out of that story. I think it's very unlikely, but who knows? Let me drop.
HRO with a comment.
HRO recognized. Now, there's a whole lot of stars out there that are called Cepheid variables, where they get bright and dark in certain periods of time, and that gives you a lot of information about the star. Meets the HRO, go right ahead. Start off with your name, so, sir. Full call and name, K2RIW listening.
Call is WB2HRO, name is Joe, and, I mean, if we use what energy strikes the Earth, that's, would be good, but we wouldn't want to take in energy like from another body that's off to the side or around or something outside of, because that means we would be taking in more energy than the sunlight. Say we get 1x from the sun striking the Earth. Now we put pull up another body nearby and take another double the amount of energy that is being used on Earth. All energy is turned into heat. Now the Earth will heat up even faster than it's heating up now. Over.
I think you're right, depending on what you're doing with that energy. Of all of the kilowatts of energy being gathered by the solar cells on the International Space Station that operates all of their equipment inside the space station, and the majority of that equipment is not doing anything to the outside universe, therefore all that energy eventually becomes heat. And so, however number of kilowatts of energy they put into the space station by the solar cells, they've got heat radiators that have to dissipate just about exactly that same number of kilowatts of heat generated by all their instrumentation inside. So the Earth is somewhat like that. However, I might decide that I want to build a really good radio telescope. And so, and I want to communicate with somebody very far away. Let me drop. And so now with my great big radio telescope, I'm transmitting many megawatts of power as a signal out in space to communicate with somebody else. Now all the kilowatts of solar energy I gather to operate that radio telescope, not all of that is going into heat of the Earth. Some of that is the energy I'm transmitting in that beam. That could be laser, could be radio, could be infrared. So there's a slim possibility that some of the energy you gather on the Earth with your advanced science experiments really put energy back off of the Earth in some other manner. I'll admit that very few things do that. But you're absolutely right. And now, when you do put a great big X number of acres of solar cells on the Earth, let me drop. And now you're gathering solar energy that used to hit the plants and the dirt and create heat. And now they're hitting solar cells and being connected, being gathered as electrical energy. And depending on what you're doing with that electrical energy, there are people predicting that you're now creating a little bit of global cooling, because the dirt underneath those solar cells is now going to be in the shadow and running cooler. So depending on what you do with that energy, if some of it with your operations is re-radiated into space at some other frequency, infrared through the heating or whatever, you might be creating a little bit of global cooling. If you think you're going to correct global heating by that means, I think we're spinning in the ocean here. Very little action. So, as far as that star's variable characteristic, it makes good science fiction. The chances of that being a Dyson sphere, I think, is very low in probability, but not zero, Rich. N2EO, K2LAW.
NWS2N on Rich's comment.
Okay, I'm done with this. I just wanted to ask. I didn't know the word Dyson sphere. Sphere. But all right, let me turn it over to you, Dick, and you can continue with Paul. It just seems very interesting. N2EO.
Yeah, the latest issue of NASA Select. No, it's not NASA Select. I'll have to go get the actual journal. The August issue. It's got a beautiful 4 or 5 page article about the James Webb Space Telescope. And maybe Paul has already seen it. I know you want to make some comments on this Dyson sphere. WS2N, at the beginning of Space Report number 213 of the series. Go right ahead, Paul. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm up to 214, but whatever. The article that Rich saw has been in the, oh, I guess in the news last couple of months, 3, 4, 5 months, maybe 6 months. Let me drop it. I didn't hear the tone. Okay, there it is. And what's happened is Kepler looked at all the different stars, and it looked at that one star, and I've forgotten the name, but yeah, Rich is right with that name. And it showed it darkening, but at an unusual rate. It wasn't a separate star. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't planets going in front of it. So they were trying to figure out what this could be, and they were imagining that it could be this mega structure that some alien group built. So yeah, that's what that's all about. So yeah, that's what some people are theorizing. And then I've seen some articles which, of course, you know, disprove that whole thing, that there's no way it's going to be that. They said it could be comets or some kind of action asteroids, something in front of the star intermittently. So, in other words, they don't know what it is yet. Back to you, Dick, and then we'll continue on. Let me go through the couple of articles that I've come across in the last week. The main one happened early this morning around 1:30. SpaceX launched another rocket to geosynchronous orbit for Japan. It launched out of Cape Canaveral Launch Complex 40, which is the one that they commonly use in Florida. And what they did was send it successfully into geosynchronous orbit. This is the second launch for Japan from that location this year. And the JCSat, this one's 16, they launched 14 about 3 or 4 months ago successfully. And of course the goal for SpaceX is always to try to recover the boosters, which they've done quite a few times, and this time it was very successful, and they landed the 15-story first stage booster, 12-foot diameter, on the barge about 400 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean, and dead center. I mean, they have two rings. They have an X on the barge looking down. And then they have two rings, you know, a bullseye type of deal. And it wound up right in the middle, because I know the first ring is about 70 feet in diameter. And the diameter of the distance from one end of the landing pads to the other is about 60 feet. And all four landing legs were within that first circle. Not even the second circle, so. I mean, pinpoint landing. And this is one of the high-speed landings without a boost back boost back is normally used if they're going to go to Cape Canaveral. So very successful. They've done this successfully now a half a dozen times. Four times on the drone ship, and then two times back to Cape Canaveral with the booster landing actually on a landing pad that they've designed at Cape Canaveral called Landing Zone 1. SpaceX also took over that complex. A complex used to be called Launch Complex Number 13. Now they call it Landing Zone 1. So very successful. So that's what I consider breaking news. On to a couple of other stories. This is WSUS. We're going to start talking about OSIRIS-REx on the net, and that's coming up September 8th. And that's well in, you know, well ready to go. It's going to launch on Atlas 5 rocket from Cape Canaveral. And they'll be launching using an unusual configuration. Just one booster rocket attached to it. Usually they'll have two or five or something like that. Just going to have one booster rocket because that's all they're going to need. Well, OSIRIS-REx is going to be going to an asteroid. It's called Bennu, is the name of the asteroid. And they plan on getting there quite a few years from now, around 2020. And OSIRIS-REx will orbit that asteroid for about a year and do detailed measurements of it, pictures. And they have a laser altimeter where they can tell the exact distance. And they'll make pictures of that thing within, I think, a couple of centimeters of resolution. They'll do that for about a year using the altimeter that's on board that spacecraft. But one of the cool things that they do have is they're going to be able to get a couple of pounds of material from the asteroid toward the end of the orbiting mission. And in turn, a couple of years after that, it's going to take a while before it comes back here. They'll send it through the atmosphere. It has a landing craft on there that can go right through the atmosphere with a heat shield and a parachute that will open. A helicopter will fly by and catch it in midair and bring it back safely to the ground for the scientists to evaluate this thing. Probably around 2023, I guess, by the time it comes back. But that launch is coming up, and we're looking forward to a successful launch, hopefully from Cape Canaveral using the Atlas. Atlas is a very successful rocket launched by the United Launch Alliance, which is a combination of Boeing and Lockheed. Let me drop it. And last week we were discussing the spacecraft that went into orbit, polar orbit, some years ago. And it was the one with the spheres, the spinning gyros. It had four on board. And I was guessing a gravity probe B, and that's what it was. But that was quite a few years ago. It was roughly 10 years ago when that did go up. I just want to confirm that, Dick. I know that we were talking about that, comparing that to Lisa. Lisa is the one that's presently L1 position between the sun and the earth. That has nothing to do with the gravity probe B. Gravity probe B was just, they wanted to check the rate at which the space-time would change as the Earth spins below. And the other one, Lisa, has to do with the gravity waves detecting them. So there's a difference. And the ones on Lisa are square type of objects that don't want to move. They don't spin. They want to stay in one space and direction and time. drop it.
WHYY.
And just, you know, a couple other topics. Raptor news. Raptor is the engine that Falcon 9 will be eventually replaced with a bigger rocket, and the Raptor engine will be part of that on the Mars Colonial Transport that SpaceX is eventually going to build. But there's very little news that comes out about the Raptor engine, and that's going to be the new engine instead of using the Merlin D that Falcon, SpaceX uses now. They'll be using something called a Raptor, and more information will come out about that in September in a conference in Mexico, Guatemala, when Elon Musk is down there. So I'm looking forward to what his ideas are really for him to eventually try to get his rockets to Mars, see how far along he's come and what his predictions are. There's more things, but we could always cover that at future time. There's problems and with the Japanese cargo vessel that's supposed to be going up. We could always talk about that. But for now, I think that's quite a bit. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, WSUN for the Space TechNet. I heard Joe, too.
Yeah, Joe, we'll wait for the beeps, and I think Joe's got a question. W2RIY, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I was going to just ask a question at the end of the space report. Are you pretty much concluded?
You've been invited to ask a question. Go right ahead, Joe.
Very good to meet you, Rolly White. Sometime this past week, I heard something in the news, some little clip on the news, one of the local radio stations, about scientists are looking at some star that's like 1,500 light years away, and over the past 30 to 100 days, they've been...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's got them kind of puzzled as to what they think could be in front of it. Have you heard anything about that? Back to you.
I heard him on the input that...
Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Rich, N2EO, just brought that up maybe a half hour ago or so. But yeah, that's the star we just talked about, where some people are imagining the Dyson Sphere is being constructed around it at this time. We kind of just covered that, Joe. Back to you.
Okay, well, I wasn't tuned in. I only turned the thing on about 5 minutes ago, so sorry about that. I guess I missed that section of the space report.
Yeah, we did.
That was right before we went to the space report. Rich brought that up. We covered it, and the end result is some people think that, you know, it would be a nice thing to try to prove something like that, but most of the evidence right now, probably they're thinking of comets and things like that that are going in orbit around this thing, and at maybe a different rate now, you know, where you know, you have different groupings of comets passing at different times, so that's why it's not consistent. But if they look at it long enough, I think they might find some kind of regularity behind it. We'll see. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, very good. And I can always rewind the tape and listen to this episode of TechNet next week as it gets recorded. Back to you.
Yeah. I've done that a couple of times. Back to you there, Dick. Any comments on what I brought up so far?
When it comes to a star becoming variable, the methods by which it can become a separate variable, there are various techniques where you've got two stars in a binary relationship, and one's quite a bit larger than the other, and one is slowly sucking material away from the other, and as that material piles onto the surface of the larger one, it creates an instability that causes a flare-up. So there's a whole lot of mechanisms by which that can take place, and you get these flare-ups. To have something pass in front of a star, a planet, an asteroid, a comet, those are very brief events by comparison the way you get a cyclic brightness out of a star is less likely to be that. It's very difficult to block a whole lot of light out of a star, whereas a separate variable can be, it can easily go bright and dim by large percentages. So a separate variable, I think, is a more likely situation. And the fact that it didn't flash very much before, and it's flashing more now, let me drop. An easier explanation for that is that there are a number of mechanisms by which a binary star system starts off at a fairly large distance between the two, and by gravity wave dissipation and other phenomena, it may be coupling between the binary stars and their planets, you can be losing some energy and the two binaries become closer together. And at a certain critical distance, when they become closer together, the larger star can start stealing material from the smaller star and therefore become a separate variable. So the fact that this star was not variable a long time ago and is becoming variable now, that's a possible explanation. The book that I went and I was gathering while you passed it back to me was the August issue of NASA Tech Briefs. And there's a very nice article in here about the Elon Musk operation, I believe it is. Human spaceflight takes a giant leap is the name of the article. And they show you the Kennedy Space Center where they're checking out the Orion module. And you see a beautiful picture of the Orion module and the testing of its booster rocket. On the testing that they did where they sent one unmanned and it landed in the ocean. So to the uninformed, it looks like a Apollo capsule, but a hell of a lot bigger. And you see the thing under construction. You get some pictures of what the inside of it looks like. So altogether, this is a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's a 6-page article about the stuff being developed right now for those who get NASA Tech Briefs.
Repeater, timeout.
There's one other article I want to bring to your attention, and that is many of us own a Baofeng UV-5R, among many of the other Baofengs. And by way of the cable and a computer program, you can program it. But let's face it, there's a whole lot of times when you're in the field and you would like to program another frequency into your Baofeng. And the programming technique compared to the previous available American-made or Japanese-made radios, the Baofeng has a programming technique that's quite different. And there are various people who have read the owner's manual and they were not able to program from the front panel. Okay, there's a guy named Forrest Schick, S-H-I-C-K, W-A-2-M-Z-G, Mike Zulu Golf, who's written a very nice article. Unfortunately, the article is in the Rochester Amateur Radio Association, the RA-RA Journal, for May of 2015, is when I recently discovered this thing. But it's a very nice article explaining it, and it's on page 8 and 9 of the May issue 2015 of RA-RA, and I can tell you how to get to RA-RA, the website. Rochester Amateur Radio Association, very active group. Page 8 is an explanation of his difficulty and how he solved it. Page 9 is a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, he gives you a 1-page, 8.5 by 11 page. When you cut it up and fold it right, just right, it becomes a wallet-sized 8-page manual that contains, I think it's 20 steps of programming information for various techniques of programming various pieces of information. It's 21 steps, plus extra tips. So it's the equivalent of 24 or 25 steps, so to speak. So when you cut up that page and fold it just right, this is a wallet-sized manual that's very easy to carry, that allows you to program from the front panel almost all of the functions you ever want to do in the field when you want to add a repeater. You know, you just travel to somewhere. somebody told her the frequency and the offset and the PO tone. Let me drop her. And you'd like to in the field, without your programming cable and without your computer, you'd like to be able to program in that frequency. So from the front panel, it can be done with this manual. So as I said, May 2015, rah-rah, page 8 and 9, very valuable piece of information. I've got that in front of me right now. And if, for those who want, I can tell you the website as to how to get directly to that exact exact monthly journal. It's a slightly long email. But knowing that alone, the May 2015 issue, probably by way of the website would allow you to go there just by a Google search. And for any further questions or comments on that one, K2RIW and the TechNet. Okay, apparently all you guys either don't want to reprogram your Baofeng from the front panel, or you already know how to do it. Let's see. Do we have some questions with reference to the space report that Paul just gave us? On any of the above, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Tech, if you get a chance, I got some comments on the boat night.
Okay, since no one has any further space questions right now, and they might in 10 minutes from now, go ahead with your comments on Bofang. I wonder how many of you own, and how easy they were for you to use. Go ahead, Rich, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. I don't own any Bofangs, and, you know, I pointed out on this repeater, a lot of stuff comes from China, and we have no choice but to buy it. But on the HTs and things, we do have a choice. I really don't think we should be dealing with China if we can help it. They're still a very oppressive society. They're a communist country. If I had my way, I wouldn't do any business with them. But I think we can at least buy Japanese. Look, at one time we were at war with Japan, but now we're at peace with them for many years, and they're a peace-loving nation. That's who we should buy from.
GB2HRO with a comment.
A2IZ with a comment.
Okay, we got HRO and IZ in that order. Mr. HRO, go ahead.
Well, the reason why they're selling the Chinese radios just like other Chinese stuff, it's cheap, and Americans are obsessed with price. Simple as that. When it comes down to it, if they want an item and somebody comes out with it cheaper, they don't care where the thing is made or what government or what. That's it. Simple as that. Otherwise, we would buying American-made stuff and multiplying the economy here. Because if I give you $100 and you make me something, you're going to spend the money here. If I buy it from China or Japan or wherever, most of that money goes out of the country and doesn't employ people in this country at a 5-to-1 ratio. Another question is, does anybody know where the... there's a website with all the repeaters in the New York area and the DL tones. Does anybody know which website that is?
Yeah, that's a darn good question, Joe. And so we'll let people search their email, their Googles or whatever. Somebody out there probably knows the website that gives us all of the repeaters in the New York City, Connecticut, New Jersey, whatever areas, Long Island, with their frequencies. It's very difficult to play completely isolation policy, if you know what I mean, Monroe Doctrine or whatever you want to call it, where we completely isolate ourselves from the rest of the world. It's tempting to do that. But the economy really is a global economy. There's pluses and minuses of the global economy. A vast majority of the clothing that we buy and the shoes that we buy and the socks that we buy and so on are made in a foreign country. Let me drop. presidential candidate that you're going to cut off all foreign material coming into the United States. Automobiles, clothing, shoes, appliances, test equipment. You could try to do that. And boy, you can create a lot of havoc depending on how far you carry it. And would you really come out ahead is a darn interesting question. It's not a simple one. To choose a particular country and a particular product and to say you want to put a big tariff on that one or I want to deny its entrance into the United States at all. And you can try to do that. And then you're going to get people going to foreign nations and buying them and importing them on as their leverage when they come back in the United States. You can't really control it. The economy really is global. And so any attempt to make it non-global, you're going to pay a heavy price. It's not easy. Let's see what John's got to say about all this. Mr. IZ, K2RIW, what do you think the solution is, John?
Hey, Dick. Well, as you know, I've been involved in public service for a very, very long time. Matter of fact, I go back to when Harry was W-2 Tango Uniform Kilo before he became W-2 HD. I heard that a while ago. A couple weeks ago, we participated in the Maggie Fisher for a space swim from Fire Island to Bright Waters. There were five boats at the mile marks, and we ran communications. I own a Baofeng, and I own a Yaesu VX6R. The VX6R, $350, not including the charger. The Baofeng, $25. Guess which radio I took with me? If that Yaesu goes over the side, I'm going in after it. If the Baofeng goes in, I get another one for $25. Back to you, Dick.
Chevy Test 2N.
Yeah, Paul recognized. John, you brought up a very good point. The fact that we can get them so inexpensively means it's a disposable item. You wouldn't risk your life trying to recover it. And if it becomes damaged, you simply buy another one. We do that with an awful lot of things these days. If I drop my toothbrush, it's so easy to get another one. I wouldn't risk my life to try to recover it, if you know what I mean. That's what Paul's got to say. WS2N, K2RIW. I wonder if you own any foreign products, Paul, automobiles, clothing, shoes, radios, and whatever, you got it, Paul.
Of course. But yeah, I agree with what you're saying. You know, it's an impressive country, and everybody's contributing to that. But if you look at NASA and the development of the International Space Station, there's 16 countries involved, and China was not invited. And so they're making their own space station, and in fact, they'll be launching one coming up this September. Second iteration of their space station, so they could afford to do it because everybody's pouring money into that country. So, you know, I get where N2EO is coming from. Back to you, Dick.
Next time with a comment.
Yeah, I think that's Rich, WB2GXM. Do you think there is a simple solution to this one, John? Rich? Of course I'm asking a left-handed question. Very few things have a simple solution. But if you had the power, what would you do, John, Rich? WB2 Golf X-Ray Mike, KQRIW, and the TechNet.
KQRIW and the TechNet, this is Rich. Actually, you are listening to Woshin. I listen to Woshin every Sunday to talk to you guys. It's getting out pretty good. I like it. It's very awesome. Unfortunately, the Baofeng, the battery craps out in half an hour. Very reliable. $65.
Yeah, the particular place where you're standing, as you move around that handy, you're going in and out of the repeater. But we did get the general gist. You're using a Luxon, I think it is. The battery fails a little bit too fast for you, but the battery's not very expensive. And some of the batteries fail fast, and some of them do not. So there's a production problem there. But quite a few people are quite happy with those Luxon and Baofengs. slightly better position when you talk to us. Previously, you were very solid, Rich. This time, you're in a slightly different position, and you got to worry about the fact that when you move around for the strongest signal on reception, it's not necessarily the strongest signal for transmission, because there's a 600 kc difference in frequency, and there's a whole lot of wavelengths between you and the repeater, and they start piling up, if you know what I mean. So give it another go. Let's see if I've picked up the your information, which was jumping out of the machine, if I got it correctly, John. Oh, Rich, WB2GXM, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, the Woshin lasts 4 hours. The Baofeng battery dies, and I've told it's a inbred problem. So the Woshin is better, but maybe I should be ditching these Chinese radios for something Japanese. K2RW, WB2GXM.
N2EO with more comments, Dick.
Yeah, that time, Rich, you were good and strong and solid, and you sounded very good. So wherever that position is, put an X on the floor, and make sure you keep going back there when you talk to us. And, yeah, you can decide to go to Japan, but I think you're going to pay 10 times higher. So it's a mixed bag. You might not want to, because of your situation of ethics, you might not want to support China. But when it's 10 times cheaper than other products, kind of hard to deny. You can fight that battle, and you can decide that you are not going to buy Chinese material. But an awful lot of your fellow amateurs are going to continue to do it. And if our government decided to cut off our ability to buy Chinese material, quite a few people would think that that's over government regulation and getting into our private life too much. Some people will think that. There's no ideal solution here. But maybe Rich has got a better solution. Rich is not going to buy any. He's going to try to talk his friends not into buying any. But in the total scheme of things, that may not make a big difference there, Rich. N2EO, K2IW, wait for the beeps.
Comment also,
we'll pick you up in a minute. Wait for the beeps there, Rich, and go ahead.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. I think in general, our country is slitting our own throats by buying Chinese because, I know the price is cheaper. And I'm not saying to cut off trade with everybody. I don't believe that. But, you know, look, I'm 66 years old, so I was born in 1950. But I know a little bit about history. Me and John, WGB, discuss it all the time. And before World War II, we were selling steel to Japan. And then on December 7th, they dumped it on us at Pearl Harbor. And I'm afraid the same thing is going to be repeated with China. They're building up a military with our money. Hey, John.
Well, hold on now. We had another person who said he wanted to make a comment. Give me your call letters and name, and go right ahead with your comment, sir.
This is Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Alpha Romeo. Name here is Gabe. And I'm also using a walk-sound radio right now, using the KGUV3D. Excellent transmit audio and big speaker in the front of the radio. I prefer this over the other radio. One thing, though, the front end of these radios aren't that great at all, as everyone might know. So you pay a cheaper price, but the receiver isn't that great. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, you can't have it both ways. The radio can go DC to light. You can program it for a whole lot of 2-meter frequencies and 450 frequencies, and many of them also get the FM broadcast band. The front end does work DC to light. And the antennas, certain models of the antennas fail rather easily if you flex them. So you get over it, you either find a way of fixing the antenna or you get the other kind of whip antenna, which works with the antenna, with the radio. But yes, that front end easily hears all kinds of signals that it shouldn't be hearing, particularly if you live in a metro area